industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Kiahi Horowitz is a medical toxicologist and teaching faculty at Oregon Health and Science University.
It was the middle of summer when her infant started teething. It must have been so uncomfortable to watch her infant son feeling that miserable. So she went to her local store, and wouldn't you know it, there in a pastel blue and pink box, she found tablets specifically for the restlessness and irritability due to cutting teeth. Just like other boxes around it, the label had an indication for each ingredient, how they addressed those symptoms, and what to watch for. And inside the package, the bottle was sealed in plastic with a safety cap. Hyland's teething tablets seemed like a safe, perfect option for her child. Then one day in early August, after taking the tablets, he looked a little tired. And then he lost consciousness, and his body started to shake. His mother rushed him to the emergency department for the first of three visits for seizure-like activity. His workup and ensuing neurologic evaluation found no answers to the mystery, and he was diagnosed with myoclonic jerks of unknown etiology. It could have ended there, but that same August, another mother gave three tablets to her then 14-month-old daughter, who suddenly developed seizure-like activity, stopped breathing, and received CPR. That was case 768-2299 in the FDA Adverse Event Reporting System, one of almost 100 cases in 2010 of excessive drowsiness, apnea, seizure-like activity, and death following exposure to Hyland's teething products. In response, the FDA released a consumer safety alert and contacted Hyland's parent organization, Standard Homeopathic Company, who voluntarily withdrew the product. The FDA's concern was that their analysis of select samples had found inconsistent amounts of the product's main ingredient, belladonna alkaloids. At pharmacologic doses, of course, this can have strong anticholinergic effects, and at toxic doses may manifest with the classic findings of tachycardia, hypertension, mydriasis, urinary retention, hyperthermia, and delirium. Now, seizures and respiratory distress are not part of the usual antimuscarinic toxidrome. But in a cohort of children in Turkey and a retrospective review of cases reported to the Swiss Toxicologic Information Center, cases of convulsions and comas have been documented following ingestions of Atropa belladonna, the plant itself. Understandably then, the FDA was suspicious that these cases might reflect toxicity from exposure to products made from the plant, but with substandard controls. Meanwhile, Hyland's, eager to get one of its most popular products back to market, instituted a new internal review process for product development and testing in 2010. And in 2011, they released a reformulated version of their teething tablets. Problem solved. Case 8341495 happened in August of 2011. She was a 5-month-old girl who became unresponsive within 45 minutes of taking only two tablets. Again, she was not the only one. Between 2010 and 2016, there were 584 adverse events reported to the FDA, of which 505 were determined to be severe and 18 died. Even if we remove the data from 2010 and 2011, presumably when people only had access to the original product, 416 serious events and 13 deaths were submitted after the reportedly reformulated product hit the shelves. To their credit, Standard Homeopathic was the reporter for several cases and internally reviewed lots and samples, reporting their negative findings back to the FDA. However, in September of 2016, when the FDA inspected the Hyland's facility in Los Angeles, they again found inconsistent concentrations of belladonna in the samples, including some that far exceeded the label claim. In response, Hyland's wrote a letter to the FDA, declaring they would cease production and sale of these products, though they didn't issue a recall. Then they released a statement on their website, a letter to moms and dads. In it, they expressed their condolences about the confusion and concern the FDA's warning must have caused those families and that it restricted access to their medications. They further stated, "We are confident that any available Hyland's teething products, including those you already have, are safe for use," and that they still took pride in their expertise in the manufacture of quality FDA-regulated homeopathic medicines. But when the FDA's latest inspection still showed a fundamental lack of control over the content of toxic chemicals, Hyland's received another letter in April 2017. The FDA has determined that these products represent a serious health hazard. Pharmacologic response to belladonna in the target population for these products is unpredictable and puts them at unnecessary risk. And so, with citations of federal law backing them, the FDA formally requested Hylands issue a recall. 7 years after the first investigation and the first death, the response was the same. Written warnings and a request for a recall, which did eventually happen. But while we had been waiting, we were hearing from the families. They bought a product off the shelf and used them according to the directions, presuming they were safe because, well, aren't they? Don't these drugs fall under the purview of the Food and Drug Administration, the same one that protected us from patent medicines and even drugs like thalidomide? Aren't all medicines in our grocery stores there because the FDA permits them to be? And if not, can't the FDA intervene before they reach the mouth of an unwitting victim? And didn't Hylands say in their letter to moms and dads they were FDA regulated? As you are all likely well aware, pharmaceuticals, by which I mean drugs designed with known and specified pharmacologic activity and provided at pharmacologically active doses, are fairly tightly regulated in this country. Perhaps not perfect, but there are processes for pre-market approval and standards for manufacturing to try to limit any harms that could come from them. But the regulatory policies around homeopathic products have not followed suit. The history here is fascinating, if tragic, and can teach us a lot about our society's relationship with medicine, our desire to be able to treat ourselves of our minor ailments, and what happens when we mix that with industry and then fail to ensure that our competing interests don't leave the patient behind. Welcome to Toxic History. Today, the FDA and the homeopathy loophole. At the turn of the last century, the practice of medicine in the US was remarkably diverse. Of formal models, Western medicine as we know it today shared the stage with homeopathy, osteopathy, chiropractic, hydrotherapy, and herbal remedy-based practices. But there was no consistent licensing, regulatory bodies, or educational standards. On top of that, Americans were spread from coast to coast in pockets of organized society. Different areas could have quite different medical capabilities and providers of very different medical philosophies and practices if one had access to a medical provider at all. And if you didn't, you might turn to trusted local sources of traditional therapies. Combining this mixed medical understanding with an era also defined by innovation and rapid industrial growth, the environment was perfect for snake oil salesmen and proprietary or patent medicines. People making and selling these products could claim whatever they wanted. We now know that most of these products, even those marketed for children, contained alcohol or other habit-forming drugs, particularly the bottles that claimed not to. In response, we passed the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Act. But even Harvey Washington Wiley, the champion of the act and the first head of the division that would later become the FDA, was soon frustrated by its limitations. Sadly, we also knew that drugs, even those made with the best intentions, had side effects. Western medicine then, even as it was praised for being founded in anatomy, physiology, and scientific inquiry, was still the practice of painful surgeries and risky therapeutics. Back in the 1780s, Samuel Hahnemann, a German physician, became disillusioned with a similarly harsh practice of medicine. He wanted better, more specific options to treat his patients, or perhaps more accurately, support what he believed was the body's innate ability to fight off disease. One of his fundamental beliefs was that the symptoms of a disease reflected the body combating its own affliction. So he thought stimulating those responses might help. This theory came after an experience with cinchona bark, a treatment for malaria at the time. He prepared and took a large dose, subsequently noting palpitations, a pounding headache, and a fever with cold extremities, symptoms not unlike those of malaria. He concluded that quinine cures malaria because it causes malarial symptoms, reinforcing the body's natural responses. This became the basis for his law of similars, or the idea that like cures like. An ideal therapy, then, was one that stimulated all the symptoms of that same disease. But if it causes symptoms, there's a risk for toxicity, and Hahnemann didn't want that. He only wanted to support what he considered the vital force of the body. So he derived a second principle, the law of minimum dose. According to this, repeated dilutions of the proposed remedy would avoid toxicity, but still provide the treating substance, even if there was no obvious clinical effect. These, of course, are a few of the central tenets of homeopathy. And under Hahnemann's philosophy, the practice of homeopathy was an extension of these. It required an in-depth history and exam to identify all of a patient's symptoms, followed by the prescription of a personalized homeopathic remedy specific to that patient's needs and administered under the care of the same homeopathic provider. It is not hard to imagine why this gentler type of patient care would be appealing. And by 1900, there were 22 schools of homeopathy in the United States alone. There was even a national professional organization, the American Institute of Homeopathy, who in 1868 started compiling the various collections of homeopathic remedies into what would become their recognized formulary, the Homeopathic Pharmacopoeia of the United States, first published in 1897. So patients, doctors, and even legislators after 1906 would have been working with a complex tapestry of medical, societal, and political ideas. And with the rise of scientific inquiry and public health, paralleling the rise of industry, capitalism, and American individualism, the political leaders of the day faced a difficult challenge: how to balance public safety, industrial innovation, and the limits of federal regulation. But just as harm to the public had brought about the 1906 Act, so too did the harms from its shortcomings bring about the next big change. In 1933, Walter Campbell, director of the Food and Drug Administration, approached Rexford Tugwell, the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, with a problem only somebody in the front office could solve. And a partnership was born. Now, that particular problem was actually Campbell wanting to set federal limits on lead arsenate pesticide use in apple orchards, a project that would enrage the apple industry. But as the two worked together, Campbell revealed that was just the tip of the iceberg. As Tugwell later recalled, the biggest frustration he had was the obsolescence of the old bill of 1906, which had put on the administration not only the obligation to prove that damage had been done by dangerous foods or drugs, but also to show that it had been done with malicious intent, which had the absurd effect of making the person who did it practically free of any obligation, because all he had to prove was he didn't know he was doing it. The more ignorant he was, the safer he was. Under this law, the administration lost case after case, not only costing the government money, but accomplishing nothing for consumer protection. Tugwell was not going to stand for this, and he brought it to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and said, "We ought to organize an investigation and produce a new bill." So that's what he did. To Tugwell, it was simple. Adulterated foods ought not to be allowed to be sold, and people ought not to be allowed to make cosmetics and other things dangerous to health. But not everybody saw it that way. Tugwell later recalled a discussion at the time with Mr. Lambert. He was the Listerine man, you know. "What have you got against Listerine?" And I said, "I didn't know Listerine was caught in this. Is Listerine poisonous?" He said, "Why, no, of course it isn't poisonous, but maybe it doesn't do exactly what we claim it does." In retrospect, Tugwell admitted, "The thing I particularly didn't anticipate was the way in which the legislators gave in to the local people in their districts or in their states. We got so around the group where we were discussing this that we talked about the Vicks VapoRub senator and the Maybelline congressman and so on and so on." Campbell, on the other hand, had not been surprised. Knowing people would need to see how important this was, Campbell, along with George Larrick and Ruth DeForest Lamb of the FDA, collected example after example of what would later be known as the Chamber of Horrors. They put it on display at the 1933 Chicago World's Fair, in the halls of power, and even the White House on Eleanor Roosevelt's request to highlight the failings of the 1906 law. From the other side, opposing interests branded Tugwell a communist, painting his bill as a threat to American business values. Now, the bill would never pass with his name on it. But this was too important to let go. As the bill sat in subcommittee, Tugwell appealed again to the president for help. Together, they decided they would just have to impress the importance of the bill on the head of that committee, Senator Royal S. Copeland of New York. As Tugwell recalled, he was a very dignified-looking, old, white-haired gentleman with carefully shined shoes, and he always wore a carnation in his buttonhole, and he looked very affluent and very genial and talked cooperatively, and he said, "Oh yes, we have to have a new food and drug bill." But if there was anyone who was going to pick up such a controversial bill, Senator Copeland, was a very interesting candidate. Before his political career, Copeland was the dean of ophthalmology at New York Medical College, or as it was known then, the New York Homeopathic Medical College. He served in that position from 1908 until 1918 when he became the health commissioner for New York, just in time for the great influenza pandemic. During that harrowing time, Copeland felt the plans to limit the spread of disease by limiting the hours of businesses, transit systems, and schools was unwarranted. Instead, he approached those businesses to come to a compromise to keep the shops open. He kept the schools open, too. Meanwhile, the rest of the Department of Health coordinated emergency health centers and ran public education campaigns, hoping to stay ahead of the game. This experience, however, would be a turning point for Copeland, as public health would become a focus that defined the rest of his career. From leadership roles in the American Ophthalmological, Otological, and Laryngological Society, and the American Institute of Homeopathy, Copeland now turned to leading the American Public Health Association, and of course, ran for senator. Even while serving in Congress, Copeland would speak on syndicated radio broadcasts about common medical ailments. And sponsoring these? Drug advertisements. Yes, Copeland was no stranger to the intersection of medicine and commerce. He had other complicated relationships as well. By Tugwell's report, Copeland and President Roosevelt did not see eye to eye, and the bill would need presidential support. But beyond the shadow of a doubt, Copeland was determined to get the bill passed. And just as he had as New York City's health commissioner, he thought the best way to do so was reconciling the needs of industries who might be impacted by the legislation. Of course, the greatest demands would come from patent medicine. As Tugwell observed, those were the people who had something to lose. In the hearings that followed, the fight soon revolved around defining what was and what was not going to be accepted as a drug. At the time, there were no agreed-upon standard formulas or accepted preparations of drugs, let alone what counted as misbranded, adulterated, or in advertisements, fraudulent. This was entirely new legislative ground to cover. So the original bill proposed using the United States Pharmacopoeia, a compendium compiled since the 1820s, and the National Formulary, a reference used by pharmacists, to serve as the standard. However, it was quickly brought up that unless there was some wording in the law that specifically gave the Secretary of Agriculture or some governing body the ability to approve the definitions of drug under the USP and National Formulary, that it was technically speaking not constitutional to give such power to these compendia. But then again, by what power or credential did the Secretary of Agriculture have to determine the correctness of these definitions in the USP and National Formulary? So Copeland's committee sought counsel from the medical and industrial associations. The conclusion, we just needed to set a standard to accept what was the accepted pharmaceuticals and what were patent medicines. After adding to Tugwell's efforts, Copeland submitted the bill to the Senate Subcommittee on Commerce with a memorandum highlighting 28 counts where no equivalent provision existed in the 1906 law, including provisions to require labels list the quantity of ingredients and use common names, to ensure packaging was sanitary, and to allow inspection of the manufacturing process. But convincing the Senate why these were necessary required something more. Citing germs of botulism being in ripe olives, to the injuries of an irreparable sort from a depilatory advertised as safe for use containing thallium acetate, to the consequences from the consumption of Ratithor, an infamous case covered in a prior toxic history. Walter Campbell, director of the FDA, testified before the committee, illustrating how the current law was not only failing, but harming the American people. But opposition to the bill won out. Undeterred, Copeland revised and submitted a brand new bill on January 4th, 1934. Tucked away among the numerous changes was one small new detail. The first bill defined drugs as all substances and preparations recognized in the United States Pharmacopoeia or National Formulary or supplements thereto. In the new bill, however, the term drug includes all substances and preparations recognized in the United States Pharmacopoeia, Homeopathic Pharmacopoeia of the United States, or National Formulary. Now, in historical context, this made some sense. Homeopathy was an accepted form of medical practice, and the purpose of the new law was to differentiate the products that might be recommended by a medical professional from the fraudulent, mislabeled, and harmful. And the bill still stipulated that products could be held accountable if it fails to meet the definition, formula, and description, or differs from the standards of strength, quality, or purity as listed in the official compendium. But the merits of adding this third formulary wouldn't be discussed, as this version of the bill died too. Standing before the Committee of Commerce 1 month later on February 19th, 1934, with yet another version of the bill, Copeland's fatigue and frustration was apparent. "I thought I had had all the troubles one could have in this life, but in all my experiences, I have never had so many worries and so much trouble as I have had in connection with this bill. I myself have been in conference almost constantly since Christmas with various groups representing the advertising, food, drug, and cosmetic industries, and with citizens who are concerned, as I am, in having the consumer protected." In the exceptionally professional discussion that followed, Copeland was grilled by his fellow senators about what was new and why they should consider this a second time. In response, Copeland proclaimed, "This bill now is a sane, sensible, workable bill. My own experience in the administration of food and drug laws makes me believe that this measure can be administered in a way to give protection to the American people. I want senators to know that there are those who continue in bitter opposition to the bill, but in my opinion, they are largely those who would be in opposition to any attempt whatever at regulation. And of course, we cannot hope to please them. We have no desire to please them. This bill is presented in order that there may be before the Senate the final conclusion of the subcommittee as to what should be included." And on the Ides of March, 1934, "The Committee on Commerce, to who was referred the bill, have considered the same and report thereon with amendments, and as so amended, recommend that the bill do pass." Now, out of committee, Copeland led his bill to the Senate floor on May 16, 1934. But the Senate would adjourn their session without taking any action on it. The FDA's annual report that June expressed their bitter dismay. "In spite of material public support, this measure, as was to be expected, aroused bitter opposition from certain trade elements, particularly the proprietary medicine industry and sections of the advertising profession, which saw in the passage of such legislation a curb on lucrative practices heretofore indulged in with impunity. A vast amount of misinformation to the effect that the bill, if passed, would result in the destruction of legitimate industries, interfere with the right of self-medication, and deny manufacturers their constitutional right was disseminated, not only among the industries, but among the public. Trade opposition, together with the congested congressional legislative program, was largely responsible for the failure of Congress to take action." But they ended with a flicker of hope. "Public interest in the purity of the food and drug supply will unmistakably grow into a united demand for effective legislation which cannot be gainsaid." And so in January of 1935, Copeland tried again, submitting the Federal Food, Drugs, and Cosmetic Act for the Senate to debate. Regarding homeopathic products, a few important distinctions arose from those debates. The homeopathic pharmacopoeia was now formally recognized alongside the USP and National Formulary as an official compendium, and it was added that whenever a drug was in both pharmacopoeias, it shall be subject to the requirements of the United States pharmacopoeia unless it is labeled and offered for sale as a homeopathic drug, in which case it shall be subject to the provisions of the homeopathic pharmacopoeia. Another important addition from the 3 years of revisions that followed was a new section requiring drug manufacturers submit a new drug application to the Secretary of Agriculture for approval prior to marketing. This application was to include evidence of the drug's safety, composition, and a full description of the methods, facilities, and controls used for the manufacture, processing, and packaging. Also during these years, the Massengill Elixir sulfanilamide tragedies served as yet another example for the urgent need for new legislation. And finally, in 1938, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was passed. Public opinion was mixed, and even Rex Tugwell felt that it was a shell of what it could have been, citing Copeland's willingness to compromise with the needs of industry. But for the first time in 32 years, the regulation of drugs took a step forward. Now, there was a wall separating recognized medical therapies and the fraudulent so-called medicines and therapies that lied to, cheated, and even harmed the public. But in this wall, a crack, one that if not addressed would widen into a hole, a loophole through which therapy would once again harm. The years that followed the passage of the 1938 law saw many changes in medicine. With the discovery of effective antibiotics and improved understanding of the pathophysiology of disease, modern medicine and pharmacology would have a heyday. At the same time, homeopathy and the other alternative practices were rapidly fading. In truth, they had been since the 1910 Flexner Report, but by 1938, their presence had truly all but disappeared. Even Copeland's own New York Homeopathic Medical College dropped the homeopathic part in 1938. Meanwhile, under the new requirements, patent medicines were unable to find footing in the marketplace, allowing for the rise of more honest pharmaceuticals. But as drugs in the industry continued to evolve, regulations had to keep up. Within 6 months of the new law's passage, the FDA would release a trade correspondence announcing that sulfonamide antibiotics were dangerous if not appropriately dosed and monitored. Within another month, the FDA recognized lots of drugs fit this description. So in December 1938, they proposed a new label be used. Caution, to be used only by or on the prescription of a physician. Now, there were labeling rules and exception for prescription products in the 1938 Act, but the FDA would take it a step further. Since these drugs and their potential toxicities carried more medical nuance than the general population would likely be able to fully comprehend, their label would be exempted from having to provide adequate directions for use written in layperson's terms. Instead, the manufacturers could substitute those directions for a prescription drug legend, which were written more for the medical community than for the general public. The FDA hoped that this would highlight the risks of these potent drugs and thus restrict their distribution. But as in the 1939 bulletin from the American Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, these drugs continue to reach the consuming public in considerable quantities and through a non-prescription sale. As it turned out, the prescription legend made for great marketing. It differentiated drugs anyone could buy from the ones physicians used. And since these products could use the prescription legend instead of directions for laypeople, they were protected from most of the regulations regarding misbranding. Which leads to an important question. Who determines what drugs ought to be available only by prescription? Is it just the harmful ones? What if the drug is safe if used according to directions and harmful only if misused? As it turns out, the FDA left these decisions up to the manufacturers. They just had to put the correct label on it. Trouble was, one company could then market a drug as prescription only, at the same time a different company could market the same drug for over-the-counter sale. And if that's not confusing enough, what about refills? It's illegal for a pharmacist to refill a prescription drug without a written prescription from the provider. But was this the prescription product or not? And if it was filled illegally, was the pharmacist or the manufacturer to blame? Bottom line, the rules around prescription versus OTC drugs was unclear. Fortunately, Representative Carl Durham of North Carolina and Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota were both congressmen and pharmacists. Their proposed 1951 amendment to the 1938 Act had a twofold objective: to protect the public from abuses in the sale of potent prescription drugs, and to relieve retail pharmacists and the public from the burdensome and unnecessary restrictions on the dispensing of drugs that are safe for use without the supervision of a physician. To define which products would be counted as prescription, the amendment recognized three categories: habit-forming drugs, drugs with toxicity, and new drugs, which by law could only be used under physician supervision anyway. These products would have to follow new labeling and prescribing rules. But the drugs that were not habit-forming, were safe for use without medical supervision, and were not new drugs, no changes were needed. They weren't prescription drugs. So where in this new dichotomy did homeopathic products fall? As Suzanne White Junot, a former FDA historian, notes in her comprehensive work on the topic, the American Institute of Homeopathy wanted a say in this determination. They contacted regulators, impressing on them that homeopathy was founded on highly individualized assessments and therapies. As such, the Institute wanted homeopathic remedies to be considered prescription. The FDA would effectively allow this, offering no specific guidance or limitations. But they also wouldn't challenge any products if they were distributed without the label. In fact, they didn't strictly enforce the prescription label requirement at all, in part due to concerns that the use of the RX symbol lent undeserved credibility to homeopathic drugs. At the end of the day and the end of the 1950s, ensuring the safety of medications that the average citizen could get their hands on was focused far more on the wonder drugs. But as we entered the 1960s, the ongoing commercialization of therapeutics and the astronomical financial growth of drug manufacturers started to raise attention. This time, by the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly. This subcommittee, first formed in 1951, the same year the Durham-Humphrey Amendment was passed, would start delving into every corner of American industry in 1955. Just 1 year after that, leadership of the committee would pass to the Democratic Senator of Tennessee, Estes Kefauver. By that time, Senator Kefauver already had a history of defending the public from exploitation, including his roles in the 1950 Seller-Kefauver Amendment to the Clayton Antitrust Act and on the Special Senate Committee to Investigate Organized Crime. So, on December 7, 1959, he would turn his new committee's attention to one of the largest industries of the day, one he was worried was making excessive profits. After 5 days of investigation and testimony, Kefauver concluded that Americans were wasting an estimated $250 million a year on what he called useless drugs. So on April 1, 1961, he introduced a bill to Senate to start addressing the excessive and unwarranted charges on the nation's sick and afflicted. Among his many goals, Kefauver wanted to require drug manufacturers provide clearer, better, and additional information on the bad as well as the good features of drugs. In his amendment, he outlined plans to standardize drug names and, in particular, require the use of generic names instead of brands, to decrease the 17-year duration of patent exclusivity, to support inspectors in evaluating factories and the processes of drug manufacturing, and to expand the requirements for licensure and FDA approval of new drugs to require evidence of efficacy, not just demonstration of safety as under the 1938 Act. As Kefauver put it, a new drug should not be approved unless it is efficacious in use for the purposes which it is intended to serve. An otherwise completely safe drug can be dangerous to the patient if it does not have the therapeutic effect which it is represented to have. The drug industry and their supporters, of course, balked. To them, regulation impeded profits and loss of funding would directly interfere with drug innovation and discovery, which would be a greater loss to the American people. On top of that, they argued, providing detailed information would disclose proprietary formulas, and informing physicians about side effects would increase frivolous lawsuits. People reading the news on the hearings, however, learned about different concerns. FDA Commissioner George Larrick would testify before the committee that worthless medicines were getting on the market because the FDA had no power to keep them off. And Dr. Frederick H. Myers testified that dangerous new drugs were being admitted to the market after frighteningly limited clinical testing on human beings. Even President Kennedy recognized the importance of the issue in his State of the Union address in January 1962. That same month, Kefauver's committee brought in representatives of the advertising agencies, revealing publicly the false claims of safety despite multiple reports of side effects. Despite all of this, the New York Times would report that although the industry's reputation with the public had been tarnished by the accusation of excessive drug profits, there had been no fall off in drug sales. Indeed, sales for most companies increased last year. But now, heading to the Senate, Kefauver's bill promised change, so his opponents started to take it apart. By July 12, 1962, many of its central aims had been weakened, if not outright removed. Then on July 15th, things changed. In the Washington Post and Times Herald, the public would read about thalidomide. Since 1960, Dr. Frances Kelsey had famously refused to approve thalidomide, and thanks to her, the birth defects affecting hundreds and thousands of European newborns had not been seen in the United States on the same scale. But back in May of 1962, Dr. Helen Tausig revealed thalidomide had been used for investigational purposes in the US, which FDA Commissioner Larrick later confirmed. Merrill, the company trying to bring thalidomide to the US market, had distributed samples to 1,200 US physicians for experimental trial despite Dr. Kelsey's refusal to approve the drug. The public, unsettled, engaged in a massive medicine chest hunt, and President Kennedy, addressing the Senate on August 1st, would call on them to strengthen the Kefauver bill. On August 9th, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to require that advertisements of prescription drugs carry statements on side effects and effectiveness. By the end of 1962, the Kefauver bill had regained much of its former strength, and with its passage would raise the standard to which all drugs were held. Ironically, the cost-saving measures that had driven Kefauver and his committee to start the whole process in the first place were practically nowhere to be found. But important to our discussion today, prior to 1962, a drug could bypass pre-market review if it was generally recognized as safe for its intended use. The new amendment now set a precedent that drugs that may have been safe but were not shown to be effective could be reclassified as new and thus still subject to pre-market approval. This created three distinct groups of drugs. Those introduced after 1962, now required to prove safety and efficacy before approval. Those from between 1938 and 1962 that may have been safe but had no proof of efficacy, and those from before 1938, grandfathered in based on years of clinical experience. The FDA recognized there was a big issue with this. So in 1964, they introduced the Drug Efficacy Study Implementation, or DESI initiative, an expert review process to bring all drugs marketed prior to 1962 up to the same new and improved requirements. Naturally, they started with the pharmaceuticals. By 1973 alone, they would remove nearly 7% of the marketed drugs they had reviewed because they were ineffective. But the FDA's task was far from complete. Thousands of drugs and tens of thousands of therapeutic claims required individual investigation under DESI, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of OTC products. So in 1972, the FDA considered a new tactic specifically for non-prescription drugs. Since there are only an estimated 200 active ingredients in the thousands of OTC drugs now marketed, why not investigate them by drug class rather than product by product? Central to this plan was the development of drug monographs that detailed ingredients, manufacturing processes and controls, and other important information that could then be applied to all agents in the same class with the same active ingredient. If the over-the-counter product conformed to the monograph, then the FDA hoped to characterize the drug as neither misbranded nor new, and thus would not have to require it go through the full approval process to remain on the market. Among the many responses to this proposal, the American Institute of Homeopathy requested that homeopathic medicines be excluded from the OTC review. Because of the uniqueness of homeopathic medicine, the commissioner has decided to exclude homeopathic drugs and to review them as a separate category at a later time. But hadn't the Institute wanted homeopathic products to be prescription only back in 1951? As it turns out, the world and industry of homeopathy had changed. In the 60s and 70s, the market share for products sold as homeopathic increased significantly, and nearly a third of all homeopathic products were now over the counter. Why this had happened could be due to a number of convergent factors. The growing recognition that drugs had side effects may have caused some people to seek alternative solutions to problems they felt weren't worth the risk. The socio-political turbulence of the 60s and 70s produced, among other things, a back-to-nature movement, so plant-derived products may have been appealing. And there were more options to advertise and sell directly to consumers than ever before. This created an ideal market to introduce OTC products. And with the FDA excluding them from all prior reviews, all homeopathic products needed to do to enter the market was have an appropriate label and ingredients listed in the pharmacopoeia as per the 1938 Act. Labeling rules were easy to meet, but how does a product end up in the pharmacopoeia? As of 2006, the criteria for inclusion were it must be safe, prepared according to detailed homeopathic specifications, and have clinical effect established by one of four main routes. Clinical verification, or proving, published documentation that the product had been in use since before 1962, at least two adequately controlled double-blind studies, or data from clinical experience. The authors here are quick to note that the last method, effectively anecdotal evidence, has not been used to include a product. The third point has been used, however contentious that may be, and the second point they note was used to grandfather in several products introduced in the 70s and 80s, perhaps coincidentally the same time that such products were exempted from the FDA's OTC review. But really it was the first point, proving, that is the primary route for inclusion. As of 2006, this process involved giving a sample population a placebo followed by an infratoxic level of the substance of interest. The test subjects are then encouraged to report any symptoms they notice to be used as proof that the product obeys Hahnemann's law of similars. The approval process then proceeds to reviewing toxicology and safety data to make dosing recommendations for prescription and non-prescription preparations, and developing a monograph to be included in the pharmacopoeia. These products can then be marketed, and entering the 1980s would find a lucrative place in the self-treatment market, one that soon became impossible to ignore. The FDA was now realizing that the industry behind homeopathic products, particularly those supported by over-the-counter sales, had gone from a few manufacturers who predominantly served the needs of a limited number of licensed practitioners into a multi-million dollar industry that, like other industries, was continuing to grow. In 1982, an investigation would further discover that several products were marketed for serious medical conditions, including heart disease and cancer. Under the law, these were allowed so long as they had the prescription labeling and met the other labeling criteria of the 1938 Act. But reviewing these to ensure they all conformed to the law would take resources the FDA simply did not have. So they introduced Compliance Policy Guide 400.400, hoping it would help streamline the evaluation of homeopathic products without requiring they undergo the full pre-market approval process. So what was in this guide? First, homeopathic products must meet the standard for strength, quality, and purity set forth in the Homeopathic Pharmacopoeia, essentially a restatement of the 1938 law. But the guide also permitted ingredients not in the pharmacopoeia, so long as manufacturers provided documentation that they were generally recognized as homeopathic. Second, the guide allowed labels to list ingredients in homeopathic terms, that is, documenting dilutions rather than weights or concentrations. But the guide also recognized that the FDA exempted homeopathic products from the requirement for laboratory determination of identity and strength of each active ingredient prior to release for distribution. Of course, this is because of how homeopathic providers understand their products, but then how do we know what's really in them? Third, for OTC products, the guide required labeling include at least one major OTC indication for use common to the respective ingredients. This might sound familiar, as we use it for OTC pharmaceuticals. But recall, homeopathic products have not undergone any formal evaluation for efficacy for a specific indication. And if they conform to the guide, they won't be reevaluated prior to marketing. On top of that, homeopathy itself doesn't consider their therapies as targeting symptoms. The treatment is supposed to recreate the disease state in order to work. Taken on the whole, these labeling requirements seem to be holding the products to a different standard than the law, let alone homeopathic philosophy. However, it was adopted, and once in effect, it did allow the FDA to move against several manufacturers. But overall, it became more of a guide for the industry to get products to market without regulatory roadblocks. Then, in 2009, Zicam, a homeopathic remedy containing zinc acetate and gluconate marketed for cold-related symptoms and sold in oral and intranasal formulations, came under FDA investigation following numerous reports of anosmia, or loss of smell, after use of the intranasal product. Zicam's ingredients are in the homeopathic pharmacopoeia, for which the approval process reportedly involves a toxicology and safety review. However, research prior to 2000 had already documented that potential toxicity of zinc on olfactory epithelium. So, with sufficient data and evidence of potential harm, the FDA was able to say under the law that the product would need a new drug application if the company wanted to continue to market it. Until then, the product would need to be recalled. In the fallout, Zicam intranasal products temporarily disappeared from the market. So what happened then, when 1 year later, 98 episodes of adverse effects to Hyaline's teething tablets were reported to MedWatch? Unlike Zicam, the teething tablets were not found to have a definitively toxic dose. Rather, testing had revealed that concentrations were variable, a fact standard homeopathic company would use to try and dismiss lawsuits levied against them. Sadly, I could not find any legal outcome or news reports for some of these cases, so either they are still unresolved, were settled out of court, or they lost. What I did find was a 2012 class action lawsuit filed against Hyaline's and Standard Homeopathic, alleging they engaged in a false and deceptive marketing campaign with the foreknowledge that consumers are confused about the true nature of their products. Because as the plaintiffs contended, Hyaline's had marketed their products as natural, safe, and effective alternatives to prescription and non-homeopathic OTC drugs, despite no testing or other evidence to support that claim. In 2015, the case went before a jury, who found in favor of Hyaline's, absolving them of all liability. Just 2 years later, MedWatch had 584 cases of children affected by their teething tablets. But the packaging didn't violate the 1988 policy guide. And under the only legal precedent applied to homeopathic products, and the only one in effect in 1945 when belladonna alkaloids were first proposed for teething products, the only violation to the 1938 Act was the inconsistent concentrations found on testing, and that only after children had been injured. We just couldn't have caught it otherwise. Fortunately, after these incidents, the FDA reevaluated their approach to regulating homeopathic products. What resulted was an effort to update their policy from one of enforcement discretion to one of risk-based enforcement. In 2019, they published a revised draft guidance and withdrew the 1988 policy guide. In the new guidance, formally adopted in 2022, the FDA identifies the 6 high-risk categories they would prioritize regulatory enforcement for, including products with reported safety concerns, those containing pathogens, controlled substances, potential toxic ingredients, or ingredients not adequately controlled in the manufacturing process, products with routes of administration other than oral or topical, products marketed for prevention or treatment of serious diseases or marketed towards vulnerable populations, and products with significant quality issues. But this is still reactionary, and as the FDA admits, does not establish legally enforceable responsibilities and should be viewed only as recommendations. And of course, there are other problems nowadays. Since I started working on this project, large budget and staffing cuts at the FDA eliminated thousands of jobs, including those in drug evaluation and factory inspection. Meanwhile, the pressures on the drug approval process have increased, with ongoing consideration for early approval. At the more extreme, people like Jim O'Neill, the current Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services, has controversially advocated in a 2014 keynote, "We should reform FDA so it is approving drugs after their sponsors have demonstrated safety, rather than also needing proof of efficacy." I think we've seen the consequence of this. Now, there is an argument to be made for things like compassionate use with patient consent, but we should be careful. The more loopholes we make, even for the best of intentions, the more risk we introduce. Today, with all this political upheaval, it seems we find ourselves back where we started. People still want to be able to mostly treat themselves rather than seek medical attention, and their understanding of medicine is largely based on the community around them. But whereas that community before was trusted keepers of tradition or local medical professionals, now it reaches as far abroad as our smartphones can take us, and often to people with the same rigor of medical training as before the Flexner Report. Meanwhile, the industries emerging from these ideas, facilitated by the internet, are growing rapidly. As a result, the medicines of our modern age general stores have eye-catching branding, promises of effect, and attestations that only the best non-toxic things are in the bottle. In many ways, we are still in 1932, hoping for a Rexford Tugwell or a Walter Campbell to find and fix the holes in our law. But sometimes it feels like we're also running back to 1905. Back then, we needed help raising attention to the need for better regulation. Even in the 1930s, we needed a chamber of horrors. But also, in all the work from the 1930s through the 1960s, even as the opposition made every attempt to not listen, minimize, or deflect, we had doctors, pharmacists, and scientists at the helm. And if that's what we'll need again, then I say so be it. Every poison center, every toxicologist, every specialist in poison information, and every educator reaching out to our communities will be and should be the ones to ask. We shouldn't exaggerate any more than we should underestimate the potential for harm. At the end of the day, the ideal homeopathic products, regardless of whether you believe in homeopathy or not, should have no ill effect at all. But so long as manufacturers continue to operate under decades-old regulations and the loopholes therein, the potential for harm remains. And if or when it comes up again, we must be the ones to know to ask the next question. We must be vigilant to see the trends. And we very well may be the ones who filed the reports needed to get larger regulatory powers into action for the safety of our communities.